All right, good afternoon. Welcome to the May DEEB meeting, Development and Engineering Advisory Board. We'll start with a reminder that this DEEB meeting is being recorded and the audio will be posted online. We'll start here with introductions. My name is Seth Halling with AKS Engineering.
Ryan Wilson with Wilson Architects.
Eric Galimo, SGA Engineering.
Mike Odrin, McKay Esposito.
Andrew Gunther, PLS Engineering.
Megan Fletcher, Community Development. Sherry Jones, SWCA.
Holmes, that's all right.
Michaela Rankin, Community Development.
Nicole Pizik, Community Development.
Noelle Levern, BIA. Sorry, we were distracted there.
Justin Wood, Clark County Association of Realtors.
Okay, and then going online, Jamie, you want to start?
Yeah, Jamie Husley, Jordan Ramis.
April?
April Firth, Director of Community Development.
Dan?
Dan Weisner, Songbird Homes.
Jennifer?
Jennifer Reynolds, Clark County Development Engineering.
Glenn?
I'm Glenn Young, Clark County Council.
Elizabeth?
Yeah, good afternoon. Elizabeth Decker with Jet Planning. Here to talk about the Clark County Housing Options and Action Study Plan. Thanks.
Steve Hornstein. All right, Jackie.
Good afternoon, Jackie Camp, Clark County Community Planning.
Jose.
Yeah, Jose Alvarez, Clark County Community Planning.
Max. Oliver.
Yes, good afternoon, Oliver Ojako, Community Planning Director, and I will be in and out. I got another meeting, so I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you. Susan?
Hi, Susan Ellinger, Community Planning.
And Teresa?
Teresa Hardy, Friends of Clark County.
And then I guess if there's anyone else online that I missed, please go ahead and introduce yourself. I guess we'll move forward. The next item is review and adoption of the minutes from the last meeting. And also just want to note, Terry Wallum is now present.
Mr. Chair, I have reviewed the minutes and I didn't have any corrections, so I move to approve.
I'll second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Next item, review of upcoming events. Megan?
Thank you, Seth. So council meetings, there was one on May 1st, a special meeting in regards to the 20-year population projections. May 9th at 2 p.m., a special meeting on Ethics Review Commission. May 16th, a public hearing regarding the 2023 Restricted Spring Supplemental. There is a June 6th meeting, but there was no agenda published at the time of this agenda. council work sessions, May 17th at 9 a.m. regarding freight rail dependent uses, and May 24th at 8:30 a.m. regarding neighborhood traffic management plan. And in regards to the Planning Commission, there is a public hearing on the 18th of May at 6:30 p.m., an amendment to an ordinance in regards to Chelatchi Bluff and surface mining overlay. And on June 1st at 5:30, housing options implementation, proposed code amendments that I believe we're going to be discussing some of those today. And that's all I have.
Thank you. Are there any member announcements? All right, hearing none, we'll continue to the next item. Unless, Megan, did you want to give an update on those positions?
Thank you, Seth. I did hear from Michelle Fenning that we are supposed to be getting word from Kathleen in regards to the first four positions that we deep recommended by the end of this week. We did have a fifth applicant, a Kent Cash from Port of Vancouver. He would be the only position, the only applicant we'd have for the fifth seat at this point. It does expire, I believe, on the 12th for applicants. So I will let you know if we get any more in.
And that would be for the public representative?
Correct. So I'll let you guys know as soon as I have information on that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
One quick correction to, I think, the agenda. I think the council work session recap, you were the facilitator on that. I was going to be the facilitator on the comp plan growth rate update.
So, okay.
Since you're the chair, you should probably be the council recap.
All right. Yeah, so with regard to the council work session, it felt like it went very well. There was a number of us that were there, and Jamie sent just a short email recap of some of the items, the feedback that we received from the council. And as part of that, I guess, Jamie, do you want to just provide a quick summary of those items just for others that are interested?
Yeah, sorry about that. I was having trouble getting the mute button off. Let me find what I sent here. Since Councillor Young is present, the two things I noticed he had asked for were if we could concentrate on affordable housing with particular focus on concrete things we can suggest to have both build smaller buildings and cheaper, and basically look to things we can do locally here to effectuate change. And I thought it would be a good idea, really, maybe if Dan and Jeff at the builders in the group might have suggestions there on what things that they're seeing in terms of what goes into the cost of the house that may be able to provide that. And in talking with some builders sort of offline about this after it, I kind of got the impression, like, if you're going to build the profit margins become greater, sort of that larger size house you build. So I'm not sure it's in a way really incentivizes the marketplace to build smaller. But Eric had a good suggestion, and maybe we can look at exploring ways if you have a smaller size house from a square footage standpoint, maybe the fees go down. both from an impact fee basis, but a permit side in order to try to better align that with what the market would be. And maybe we can discuss that. And then Glenn had also asked us as a be sure to try to find a way to look to include more viewpoints with the DEEB. And I know that we strive to do a really good job of reaching out to the various constituencies in the community that we certainly represent. And I know that there is a period for public comment. So I just think that's something for us to be mindful about going forward. Councillor Marshall, she also talked about housing density and building smaller houses. She wanted us to consider the new climate change goal being added to the Growth Management Act and how that could get feathered into the county policy and land use code. She was really interested in housing finance. And again, I think this might be an opportunity for DEEB to educate the council on all of the things that go into the cost of housing. And, you know, it may be worthwhile to do a work session on that. I think, and maybe really bring in some builders to explain the pro formas and the how stuff gets built and financed. And then she finally talked about aggregate and looking at that potential for changes there in the growth update. Councillor Belcott didn't provide much other than she said she was looking forward to coming to a DEEB meeting and learning more and maybe providing input at that point. And then Councillor Bowerman suggested that there should maybe be a board liaison, and that's somebody from the council that sort of raises their hand and attends DEEB meetings. And I don't know if that's what Councillor Young is here to explore. But again, we welcome him today. And she also said she really welcomed from hearing from us a bit more. The only other thing I would want to reiterate from my perspective is just historically in the past, the format for meeting with council has been in the workroom that we're, you know, at least those of us that are present in person are in. And it was kind of a more of an informal discussion and dialogue. It felt a little bit stilted to me to be in the format of a formal sort of hearing presentation. And it didn't really, I think it could have stifled some good constructive feedback and that dialogue that we've strived to have in the past. And so my strongest suggestion would be for us next year to really push the county council back into the workroom. So with that, I'll be quiet.
Thank you, Jamie. I appreciate that summary. You know, the notes I'd taken, it looks like you've covered most of those items as well. I know Glenn touched on how important it is that we have like non-biased input consideration of those opposing views. And, you know, part of that, I think, is important to have, you know, the communication and the discussion between council and DEEB being out in the open and to be able to see, you know, maybe even that we're invited or, you know, that the discussion isn't limited to the 3 minutes as in a public hearing or in that setting. So I think, you know, it'd be really good if there is an opportunity for us to, you know, move back to that. I know Eric touched on that during our work session there. I thought that was a really good, you know, idea. So I don't know if Eric or Mike, if you guys had additional.
I unfortunately packed my notes from that, so I cannot be a contributing member of this board today, and I apologize.
Just a few, kind of just the tone of it and the format. In the past, it's been more of like a roundtable discussion, and I liked when we had it in here. And we really didn't even go over a lot of the stuff that they have in writing, because they can read that. So we didn't really, in the past, we haven't gone over each of our items. You know, what we've done is kind of touched on some of the highlights and some of the priorities, but not read through our whole report. And then we just kind of had just a general discussion. And I think that's what we might need to try to do next year again. And I think the real focus that we should have is how do we have more of an impact? How do we do what we're supposed to be doing? And, you know, it came across to me that in the past, we used to be part of hearings, and anything that was development related, we actually attended it, and we weren't the general public. We were their advisor. So staff would present, D would present, and most of the time we were on the same side, because we already worked it out in advance, and we came to a compromise, and a lot of it was, you know, we support staff, but sometimes what I think we're good at as a board is finding those unintended consequences of some of these policy decisions before they actually hit. And for us to do that, we have to be able to speak at the hearing and make sure we can adequately advise them. Because if we're just submitting in writing and it gets buried with a bunch of other testimony, or we're held to 3 minutes, that's not enough. They need to be able to, council needs to actually be able to ask us questions, and we need to be able to respond on development issues, because that's what we're experts in that field. That's why we're on this board, and that's what we're supposed to be doing. So I feel like we haven't been able to live up to our potential in the last couple of years. I think it's kind of after COVID, things have just changed. The hybrid format's a little bit frustrating as well. And almost every hybrid meeting I go to, there's some kind of it is. There's a glitch, or there's a little bit of confusion, or just it's not the same as just being in the room together. So I think that's part of the things that we can do better. But we got into the weeds a little bit on some items, but that happens. And let's see, I think that was kind of the gist of my thoughts on it afterward.
How about Ryan? Did you have?
No general comments like that. I have thought a bit about the making smaller houses more affordable. I don't know, is this the time we want to talk about that kind of stuff, or do we want to put that as a later agenda item?
I guess, you know, it might tie into the housing actions plan item.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that would be maybe more appropriate.
I'll hold off then.
I have one other comment I forgot about. In the past, too, we were the only item on the agenda with the board. And when we got there, we actually sat there for 2 hours pretty much with the Board of Health meeting. And it was a lot of resources kind of waiting to go. And in the past, we've been the only item on the agenda for our work session. We started at 10 o'clock and we held it at 10 o'clock. We didn't have to, you know, sit through the public health. Because I think what happened, too, is the board was pretty much fatigued when we got up there. They had heard a lot of stuff about the Board of Health meeting, and they just wanted to kind of move on, I think, which I don't blame them, because we were in the same boat. So that's another suggestion.
Yeah.
Make sure next time we do it, we're the only thing on the agenda.
I think
and we have a full hour.
We should get that scheduled like in January or February, because it seems like it takes us, you know, we're out 6 weeks, 2 months from when we even start thinking about it. So let's just get on an agenda and just have it done, kind of like camping trip, you know, you book it 9 months in advance because you want that best spot, and let's maybe think about doing that. In fact, let's do it now. No, I'm kidding.
All right, well, move forward then to the third item, the housing options action plan. Not sure, is that Jose or Susan or Jackie?
Yes, I'll get us started. This is Jackie Camp, Clark County Community Planning. I'd like to introduce, some of you all have already met her, but Elizabeth Decker from Jet Planning. She is a part of the consultant team that the county hired to assist us with the housing option study and action plan, and now with the implementation of the plan. So she's has her expertise in housing code writing throughout the region. So I will go ahead and pass it on to Elizabeth. And before, I think she has this in our slides, but and you have on your calendar, but the next meeting for the Planning Commission on these is June 1 for their work session and June 15th for council hearing. And we are also including some minor comprehensive plan amendments that we will be proposing so that they align with these code amendments that are going through the process. So that's all I have for now, and I'll pass it on to Elizabeth. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you, Jackie, and thank you, members of the board, for having me here today to present and hopefully spend most of our time discussing the proposed code updates for this first package of development code amendments to help implement the Clark County Housing Options Study and Action Plan. So, you know, it wouldn't be a meeting if we didn't have a PowerPoint. So let me pull that up. And just get this started. Great. So we are here today talking about this first package of code updates that focus on middle housing. And it's interesting that the council work session touched on this, also about smaller single family options and ways to amend the Clark County Unified Development Code in order to better facilitate that. So let's see where we're going here. Great. So I know that Deeb has been really involved in reviewing the HOSAP, and several of your members have been engaged in this implementation process, but we'll just give you a quick refresh on the plan itself and then get into the detail of the code updates. Refresh, give you the dates for the review schedule. Jackie just mentioned some of them. And then we will have opportunities for questions and comments throughout the presentation on the code updates, but save a little bit of time at the end too for anything that we haven't covered. So just to refresh your memory, or if this is new for you, welcome. The Housing Options Study and Action Plan was undertaken coincidentally right at the beginning of COVID is when we started this project. So spring of 2020, and we set out to understand the local housing challenges in the unincorporated Vancouver UGA. So this is really the urban area of the county. And so where the focus of our efforts were, looking at ways to create more housing that is affordable to low and moderate income households. And we really developed a whole range of strategies that are included in the plan. Many of them, you know, focus on things that are directly in the county's control, like removing regulatory barriers in the development code, but also other strategies, including partnerships and other financial incentives, those types of actions as well. And the overall goal being that we can provide a much broader variety of housing that is affordable and high quality and meets the needs of future generations and the changing Clark County household composition. So the plan itself came together and was adopted in May of 2022, so a year ago, essentially today. And as I mentioned, there's that range of implementation strategies, and we sliced them and diced them in many different ways, some different topic areas, one of them being, you know, really regulatory improvements through the code, and then three different timeframes. So, you know, the first being sort of the immediate short term, and then some medium and long term. And so the direction that we got from the county council was both to adopt and endorse the plan, but also direction to staff to begin implementation of those short term code based strategies. So, you know, a subset of those strategies. And among that subset of strategies, we have further broken it down into two phases. The middle housing, you know, along topic lines, just for continuity. So the first phase that the draft code is prepared and that is under discussion today is those code updates on middle housing and smaller single family. And we are just getting started actually on phase two, the multifamily and affordable housing code. We're at the very beginning of that phase. It's sort of running. The two phases are overlapping a little bit, but we expect to be coming forward with draft code and recommendations in the fall on that. But today the focus is on middle housing and smaller single family. So I'm sure no surprise to any of you all that housing is increasingly expensive in the Vancouver UGA, our study area, as well as just, you know, across the county, across the region, across the state, whatever geography you want to look at, we're looking at, you know, much big increases in rents and home prices, astronomical increases really compared to wages. So part of the reason that we focused in on middle housing within the housing options plan and within this first phase of code updates is just the unique benefits that can help meet some of these specific needs in the Clark County context. It won't meet all of the needs of the county, but that's why we have multiple phases as well as multiple strategies and multiple timeframes. So this particular package of code really has some focus benefits around encouraging those smaller homes, as we see an increasing number of smaller households, 60% of Clark County households today, and projected to be a larger increase in the future, will be 1 to 2 people. And so they're, you know, not all, but many are looking for smaller homes. Looking at homes that can be built really at a neighborhood scale, the county land distribution, as many of you know from being engaged with the county long-range planning efforts, is, you know, a preponderance of these lower density traditionally single family neighborhoods. So there's a lot of land available where neighborhood scale solutions could fit in. And then these housing types also can be less expensive, not necessarily, you know, affordable with a capital A in terms of like government regulated affordable, but just, you know, lower costs that can be more attainable for medium income, some of the workforce households that we're hoping to meet the needs where options are currently limited. And, you know, as I said, we began this in 2020, and as we've gone along, really the need and the opportunity to align with momentum at the state and the county level has only grown. So here we are in 2023, and we have the opportunity to align both with HB 1220 that was passed in 2021 at the state level, that's really looking at how do counties and jurisdictions meet housing needs across all different income bands. And so, you know, as I mentioned, middle housing is not going to solve all 5 income bands as broken down here in this graphic, but it is an important tool to help get us at sort of this 80 to 120% AMI in terms of some alternatives to single family detached or smaller scale. So the county is working on implementing that at a much larger scale through the 2025 comprehensive plan update. But this work, you know, really is rowing in the right direction, whichever metaphor you prefer there. And in terms of our implementation, as I mentioned, we have been really lucky to have several members of DEEB engaged in our series, our technical housing code forum series. It's been really valuable to get input and to go back and forth about which code pieces, you know, can create opportunities or which pieces are barriers, and really just get that ground truthing against development realities. So we've had a range of forum participants, as well as some members of the Planning Commission and members of the original, what did we call it, the technical advisory group for developing the plan itself. And so we've worked with that, with the participants in those forums over a series of forum meetings. We've also had a public meeting and comment period, and we're now in the legislative process, having gone to Planning Commission for a first work session, and with those work sessions and Planning Commission hearing coming up in June. And so engaging with DEEB is also a critical part of this adoption process, and looking to build on the comments and input that this group has been able to provide both, you know, to the plan as we were developing the strategies a year ago, and then now coming back and getting some of your more nuanced and detailed feedback on what those strategies are looking like as we're implementing them. All right. Any questions before I get into the detail, some of the more details of the code updates? Yes? No?
Nope.
Okay, great. So let's talk a little bit about the code updates. So in terms of the code updates, and just giving you sort of the lay of the land, the scope, these are focused on the R1 zones in the county. So what are currently called the single family, but we're now proposing to call the low density residential districts, since there will be more housing types permitted than just single family. Some of these middle housing types, we're also proposing to introduce into the medium density zones. That's going to be part of phase two. So we really focused this code update on just these. This package is really focused on the R1 zones, and looking at enhancing both those smaller single family and then expanding the middle housing options. So specifically this range of ADUs, duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes, cottage housing, a new type that we're calling compact lots that is fairly analogous to cottage housing in terms of scale and density, as well as townhouses. And so the way that I structured this presentation is we've got six code update concepts, right? And they to summarize the different code strategy, you know, the actual code updates across the different chapters in the code. And we can just talk through these six, and after, you know, as part of each concept, would welcome your feedback, you know, sort of as we go along, and then we can also reserve some time at the end for overarching comments or issues that maybe didn't get cleared up in the presentation or other things you'd like to see addressed. So the first concept really that we looked to implement across the code updates was using the existing land more efficiently. I know, you know, many of you have been involved in the buildable lands model, and just how the urban growth areas get set. So making the best use out of that land. And one tool that we looked at was decreasing the minimum lot sizes in all of these zones for single family homes, which allows more homes to get built on the same amount of land. Generally, we looked at about a 10 to 20% decrease across the zones. And then we heard the importance of, in order to make those lot size decreases meaningful, that it was necessary to make some adjustments to the lot dimensions, the maximum densities, and also the lot coverage that was permitted to make that work. So this is what the proposed lot adjustments look like across those five R1 zones. clever readers will notice that, you know, R120 currently references that 20,000 square foot minimum lot size. There's going to be a bit of a interval right now with these proposed changes to the minimum lot sizes. The numbers no longer match the names of the zones, but they're not proposed to change at this time. So the R120, we looked at the full 20% decrease there to 16,000, and then you can see the range of decreases across those zones. One thing that we tried to do with this 10 to 20% is in decreasing the minimum lot size for a given lot or for a given zone, we didn't want to decrease it so much that it stepped on the toes of the next least dense district, right? So like R16, for example, is at 6,000. We could have done a 20% decrease down to 5,000, but that would essentially turn it into the R15 zone. And so trying to preserve some sense that we weren't just doing a stealth rezone, trying to preserve some fidelity of the existing zones. We did try to keep within the range of the existing zones rather than moving entirely to a different zone. With these decreases, another thing to point out is that these are all proposed to be averages. So for new subdivisions, you know, any individual lot can be slightly different as long as it averages out. That was permitted for in a few zones, but not all under the current code. We also propose to use these minimum lot widths and depths, turn all of those into averages as well, along with some modest decreases in those numbers to make them match a little bit better. And then we spent a lot of time talking about in our forum series about this maximum lot coverage. Currently, it's 50% for all housing types across all of these R1 zones. And with the decreases to the minimum lot size in R16 and R15, we heard some interest in increasing the lot coverage in order to, in order to keep a building footprint that would match some of the product that is moving forward. So we had a lot of discussion, it sounds like some of which was reflected in your recent council work session about trying to keep the scale of homes relatively small to encourage that that less affordable option, or not less affordable, less expensive housing option, but also wanting to be reasonable, right? The whole point in decreasing this minimum lot sizes is to encourage more homes to get built. So setting a number that was conducive to development while also balancing the scale of new homes. And these are the numbers that we came out with. So any questions on this first concept?
Yeah. Hey, Elizabeth, this is Jamie. I just have a comment.
Please.
In regards to the maximum lot coverage, and it's just something I'm starting to see on the Oregon side of the river as we're beginning to implement House Bill 2001 and multiple units being able to be placed on lots. The lot coverage aspect, if that's placed into the code, can have a barrier to doing more unit production on lots. And so I think we really want to be thoughtful with that. If and when Washington moves to sort of abolish single family zoning, like Oregon has done, so that doesn't become a barrier to production there. And I know some jurisdictions like City of Salem basically don't have maximum lot coverage for sort of similar purposes. And I don't know, I just always felt that was a vestige of times gone by when you were trying to preserve, you know, yards for people. But, you know, I think as we're discovering density is kind of becoming the name of the game now, sort of over yards.
Yeah, thanks. We'll talk about some of the proposed lot coverage when we get into the middle housing types. But yeah, you'll see that we are proposing more lot coverage for those to try to, again, hit that balance and accommodate all those things you're mentioning. So thanks. All right. So great segue. Thank you for that. Next piece we're looking at is more housing variety in more neighborhoods. So this is where you see introducing these duplexes, townhouses, and cottage housing into all zones. We looked at triplexes and quadplexes, and the balance of feedback that we got from the forum participants and the public was to focus those in select zones. You'll see we thought that R120 and R110 maybe weren't the best locations for triplexes and quadplexes, but the other zones could be. We're going to get into a lot more. We have a whole nother concept about the compact lot development that I can give you some more details on, but that is being proposed across all zones, analogous to cottage housing, and then, of course, continuing to permit ADUs in all zones. And, you know, as Jamie just mentioned, we don't have the Washington version yet of what, you know, a middle housing bill would look like statewide. So, you know, we did our best to think about what would be right for these jurisdictions based on what we see in Oregon, the discussions we are seeing in Washington. It sounds like there are some bills moving forward that might affect that this year. Could be the year, but in the interim, wanted to take as much action as we could to provide those housing types that we know that there are opportunities for. So thinking about the, yes.
Yeah, I just had a quick question. This is Mike Odrin. I noted that on the proposed lot adjustments a couple of slides back that you're maintaining maximum lot coverages and just slightly increasing them a little bit in the R16 and the R15. Would that lot coverage include only the primary dwelling, or would that also include any ADUs if ADUs are going to be allowed in all of the zones?
Oh, great. There will be that's coming in a couple slides. There is additional lot coverage proposed for ADUs.
Very good. Thank you.
Great. Yeah. Smart group here. You guys are anticipating all the adjustments that we've also been trying to work through. So great. In terms of the housing types, right, we got our single family, we got our accessory dwelling units. We're expanding duplexes into all zones. Those are currently only permitted as corner units in R16 and R15. Triplexes and quadplexes, as I mentioned, sort of the balance of output input felt was that those would be more appropriate in the R1 7.5, R1 6, and R1 5 zones. Townhouses being expanded across the board, right now they're only permitted as part of PUDs, and we saw opportunities to permit those in all zones. However, with a limit on two attached units in the R120 and R110. And the thinking there is that it really provides an analogous opportunity to duplexes, but with an easier path to ownership, so that there's two attached units, but two separate lots. And so those could be sold separately. Because we've also heard a lot from the Planning Commission and Council about the interest in having more home ownership opportunities. Cottage housing currently is not permitted in R120 and R110, and we saw the opportunity to expand that, as well as introduce this new compact lot development, which is, again, similar scale as cottage housing, but a different site layout. So recommended in all zones. Any questions about that before we talk about what some of the lot sizes and lot coverage for these housing types are to hopefully make them more feasible?
Hi, this is Terry Wallum. I was, in regards to other zonings with greater density, let's say like R12 or R9, is the intention that there would be similar flexibility provided to those zonings as well, or just for this mid-range zoning? Sorry if I misunderstood and you already explained that.
Yeah. So I think that you're talking about the R12, right, is when we get into the medium density in Clark County.
Yeah.
Great. And then there's also an R18 and an R22. And we explored doing the middle housing in those zones as part of this package of code updates and decided to hold on that part. Essentially, we're packaging it with the phase two code updates so that we can do a more holistic look at the medium and high density residential zones. But yes, that package will include this same similar middle housing types. And in fact, one of the interesting parts about introducing them in the middle medium density zones is with these changes being proposed in R1, is making sure that we haven't made R1 more liberal in some ways than what's currently in the medium density zone. So we want to make sure that we catch up in the medium density zones.
I have a quick question as well. So I'm looking at opening cottage housing to these larger lots. I'm under the assumption that that means there would be multiple cottages on the lot and not just a single dwelling.
An individual lot likely wouldn't be large enough for a cottage development. Even if you had a 20,000 square foot lot, that wouldn't meet the minimum lot sizes or density for a multiple unit cottage development. So this is probably more likely to apply to, a 1 to 3 acre parcel in one of those zones in the R110 or the R120 zone, where instead of dividing it into, say, 5 or 6 larger lots, it could be divided into double that number of cottages.
Thank you.
Great.
One other quick question on the townhouses in some of these zones, even with the lot sizes you have, it's not going to work. The lots are going to be too wide for your average townhouse. Those lots tend to be quite a bit smaller. And when you look at like a pure density, if mm-hmm. you have, let's just say a 4,000 square foot lot, mm-hmm. and you could put on a 4,000 square foot lot, you could put a triplex or a duplex. You're getting, 3 units on it. But if you do a townhouse, you can do 4 units, but the lot sizes don't change. So you really can't do it. It doesn't actually work, because the lots are too big to really do a townhouse. So it can be on there, it's just never gonna get used. But the one downside to that is if you take the lot sizes do go down. Okay, yeah. I didn't see that on the other piece. Okay, yep, I was jumping ahead then.
No problem, okay. Eric, I went through that same thought
process. Yeah, sorry.
And Right. And this is exactly why we're here, is to get some feedback on like what actually seems feasible. I know that we struggled with, like, you know, throughout the forum series, I won't use the verb struggle. We explored the opportunities of how do we provide a wider range of housing, even in those much larger lot size zones, but also keep it scaled in a way that, you know, is more reflective of the existing development. So it's a real balance, and we certainly welcome feedback. So I think next point I just wanted to make is when we're looking at these different housing types, right, remembering that it can be both entirely new development contexts, multi-acre sites that are being built from the ground up with all middle housing or a mix of middle housing. It can also be single lots that can be in individual neighborhoods. And so, you know, some of the new numbers that we're looking at are trying to anticipate both of these scenarios, and also understanding that there are some nuances and differences. So when we talk about that neighborhood scale, this is, I think, where hopefully we'll address a lot of these good points you all are jumping ahead to think about the feasibility. So it's setting the lot sizes for these middle housing. We proposed a tiered lot coverage structure so that additional lot coverage goes along with additional units to make it more feasible and perhaps be, you know, a bit of an incentive to make those happen. And then, as you all know, there's always talk about design standards. And some jurisdictions have explored, you know, more significant or more detailed design standards with both single family and subdivisions and middle housing. Clark County, you know, overall on that spectrum has relatively few design standards currently. And so we mostly wanted to sort of, you know, create parity for these new middle housing types as we brought them in. It didn't seem right to slap on a lot of architectural design or detailing standards just for those housing types that aren't required for other housing in single family neighborhoods. But we did hear, you know, the balance of concern really seemed to be around the street frontage and how those homes are going to relate to the sidewalk and to the street, and how parking spaces and garages balance against the actual dwelling units. And so there are some very limited targeted design standards recommended for a subset of these middle housing types to try to help them integrate better into neighborhoods. So the key parts here are, it looks like a lot of you are following along with your printouts of this presentation, so you can see the lot sizes for middle housing. Top line are the single family home standards, the adjusted lot standards that we were talking about in the first concept. Duplexes being proposed on lot sizes, the same size lot as single family home. Have heard some feedback that may or may not be feasible in some zones, that there might be desire for slightly larger size lot sizes for duplexes. Absolutely fine, can always happen. But the key of ensuring that the lot sizes are equal is just because it dramatically expands the number of lots that are then eligible for a duplex. So rather than having to size the lots in advance or adjust the lot sizes to get that extra, you know, bit of square footage to qualify for a duplex lot, just all lots of the same size are eligible for both single family or duplex. Triplex is slightly larger in most zones, quadplex as well. And then the townhouse minimum lot sizes, I think, you know, Eric, to your point earlier, these are ones we generally looked at a 2,000 square foot lot size as being more feasible for a townhouse. The larger lot sizes, the 4,000 and 3,000 for the R120 and R110, I think you see the compromise that you see embedded there is the idea that these aren't necessarily a townhouse, you know, a row of multiple units per se. This is more about creating two attached homes that can be divided as individual units in a for sale homeownership model. Less, and again, it's only two attached units in those zones. So that was the idea behind this. If that seems of interest, would be good to get your feedback. If that doesn't seem like a product that would be of interest or an opportunity, then would also like your feedback on that. Let me just flip forward through a few more, and then we can have a conversation about all of this. Going along with that is the lot coverage proposed for middle housing. And this is the tiered approach that I was talking about. So for a duplex and for an ADU, you know, once you get out of the R120 and the R110, where you just, you know, 50% of a 16,000 square foot lot is plenty of room, then we're looking at about a 5% bump to get that second unit. And then another 5% if you go to a triplex or a quadplex, and then another 5% for townhouses is the numbers that are proposed. And then the third piece that I mentioned, the design standards, looks at requiring a main entrance that faces the street, and then capping garages and driveways at 50% of the front facade. So trying to get more towards the duplex example on the right than the one on the left. And here's where I'll pause for feedback and questions.
So on those design standards, I'm looking at some homes that are built quite often in Clark County, and they don't meet those standards. And they're some of the most affordable and nicest looking homes that I would say hit that middle housing segment. And I've got like three examples right in front of me of homes that are pretty desirable, and they build them all over Clark County, and they don't meet those design standards. I just think that having standards like this, it's going to make projects not feasible, or it's going to make them not affordable. Some of these standards, you have to put it on a lot of times the square footage is not driven by the front facade. It's driven by having three bedrooms and 2.5 baths. And that's what a typical family needs. And when you try to put those features in a given space, you end up with the size of the home. And it's usually the second story. The first floor is basically what's extra space. So you basically take that second story, and that's what you have to work with. And you try to work within the structural members of that. You need a kitchen, you need a bathroom on the main floor, and you need a great room, pretty much. That's it. And you can make it into, it can be smaller or larger, but it's really governed by the size of the bedrooms upstairs. So when you start limiting the size of garages, what you end up with is a home that has smaller garage or no garage or something like that, and it throws the whole space of the home off, and you end up building more to actually have a less valuable home and a less functional home and less desirable home. It won't appraise for as much. One of the main components on appraisals is the garage space. And it's also the cheapest thing to put in a home. And as homes get smaller, you need more storage. So a one-car garage, you're basically saying with this front facade that if you have middle housing, you can't put a two-car garage, even if you have the space for it. And it might just fit perfectly under the second story, which actually drives the size of the home, like I mentioned before. So I would get rid of the design standards and let the market decide what's actually functional and what people want to buy. They're not going to build homes that people can't afford or they don't want.
Great. Thanks, Eric. Dan, I see your hand up.
Yeah, we've had this discussion in our meetings. I think that having a design standard for the garage width being, you know, maximum 50%, yes, it will make the houses look nicer and they will flow better, but you won't even see them because I've built a lot of townhouses, Jambazala, you know, when I went through the narrow lot standards with when they were just proposed codes, he basically said, we like your developments because the cars aren't stuck on the road. And that's what happens. Exactly your picture right here. The one on the right shows when you have a single car garage, you're going to have two cars stacked in front of it in depth. And typically you're not going to be that deep. So that what happens is you have a car on the road. So your neighborhood just ends up being this parking lot on the streets. It doesn't fit in. People don't like it. There's a lot more issues with, you know, just weaving in and out of traffic to try and get through stuff. So I think that this whole thing around the garages being limited is a very difficult. It's a great idea for the design look, but you're not going to see that because you're going to see all the cars on the road.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Hi, this is Terry Wallum. I just wanted to reiterate the same comments, is that in regards to parking and the impact on the surrounding community, as well as for that specific home, having two cars deep, you end up blocking sidewalks and having impacts that it creates for surrounding areas and cutting off those walkways that help to provide for public safety. So that's an unintended consequence that would take place, as well as I understand the concern in regards to the appearances and that trying to avoid detrimental impact. But again, as it relates to the cost of building new compared to anything existing, it's expensive. And so you really have to be very forward thinking in your design. It has to be attractive, appealing, desirable. And there's the other functional factors that Eric mentioned as well. So if you build a product that is not desirable, you will be punished in the marketplace for it. And it has to be something that looks right and feels right. And I understand that there's concerns there, but I guess I would like to see what housing that has been built in the last 5 years that would be of concern as relates to design. And I feel like in general, what we see is something that we all could be proud of and feel good about and enhances our communities. And so if that's not an issue, then I would recommend staying away from trying to police an aspect of design just because it creates the limitations that we've been communicating. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Just not to pile on, but just I 100% agree with everything that's been said. I don't know if there's other things you can do to, I don't see it as a big impact, the house on the left and the house on the right. I actually prefer the house on the left. The house on the right looks like exactly what it's doing. I mean, it looks like you're doing that flare or whatever to make up for that difference. So all that's going to do is drive up the cost for sure. And if you take away flexibility, it's also going to take away the incentive for anyone to build anything like that. So I think that's a pretty large issue, actually.
Yeah, great. Glad talking through it here.
Houston, I'll just give a little comment. I'm 100% in agreement with the comments that have already made in regards to the single car garage. I think right now this conversation is getting a little limited to attached products, but the way this code is being proposed, it's getting put on compact lots as well, which could handle detached product. And there is a ample amount of product that's being built in a detached manner right now in Clark County that would be on a compact lot that would be banned. It wouldn't have two-car garage. It's going to kill affordability for a large portion of the market. The porches sound really great, but when you look at practicality on what is being built right now and what actually looks nice, it's going to be essentially banned. Everybody's going to have to go retool their products. The product that looks nice and selling right now is going to get killed. And I can rewrite the garages, the space. These design standards are going to kill affordability. They're not going to help them.
Thanks. Also, just one clarification to offer is that anything that can be built today, right, those housing types are not, we're not proposing new, that these design standards would apply to housing types that are already permitted. This balanced street frontage standard is specific to triplexes and quadplexes that are being proposed. where you've got that additional pressure of those additional units, and looking to balance how they fit into a neighborhood that, you know, could have some single family detached, could have a mix of townhouses or other things, but it's focused on those triplexes and quadplexes. And then when we say compact lots here, it applies specifically to a new set of regulations for what's being termed compact lot development, not just sort of lowercase c compact of smaller lots. So if you can build it today, the standard generally doesn't apply, but it's for development under some new standards. And again, it's intended to balance sort of the additional decrease. It's intended to go along with the decrease in scale of these compact lots, triplexes and quadplexes, and try to help them fit into the neighborhood. And you know, this feedback is really welcome about whether that's going to make it useful or whether it's going to, you know, really decrease interest in these new housing types. But just, you know, if that changes any of the discussion, wanted to offer that clarification.
I think that when you look at the codes for narrow lot development, which we already have, mm-hmm. and as Houston pointed out, it basically limits you to a 10-foot driveway. So that would force you into a 10-foot maximum door. So you need to clarify the code a little bit. I think that's a great segue into we probably need to have something in the code that says if there is a conflict, the least restrictive interpretation needs to be taken into consideration. Or an example would be I looked at the code and it says that for detached garages, 18-foot max height. But if it's an ADU, if there's an ADU on top of it, it allows 25 feet. So you could be in there saying, okay, I want a garage, and get stuck an interpretation, which right now the county is instructed to take the most restrictive. So they would say, oh, it's a garage, so it can only be 18 feet max, even if you put an ADU on top. So there needs to be some leniency built into the code with all these changes, I think.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, let us move to, I think that's a good segue to talk about a little bit more detail about what these different compact lot options look like. So the bigger picture umbrella here is we're terming these some different clustered development options. And so right now that mostly takes the form of cottage housing under the county's current code. And so we heard a lot of tensions throughout the code audit and the housing options plan development process, as well as through our housing forums, about the cottage housing code is trying to serve a lot of different types of development right now. And it's sort of being tugged in a lot of different directions, leading to, you know, some folks saying, no, this is what it was always meant to be. No, it was always meant to be this. And we really saw an opportunity with these code updates to clarify and meet more needs through two more distinct paths. And so the proposed code updates sort of refocus the existing cottage housing option on more of a clustered development cottage housing option, but to also meet the need for smaller scale development at an analogous scale and density to cottage housing, we're introducing the compact lot development that allows for more of a street-oriented layout, but at the, you know, again, the same lot sizes and density as cottage housing. So different lot organization, same, you know, overall intensity. And then we also saw just, you know, as a third potential path, reducing the minimum lot size for PUDs to make those an option for smaller lots as well. If there's something, you know, really creative and unusual and just that falls outside the bounds of this. So, you know, as many of you probably know, when people talk about cottage clusters, the discussion often starts with this more, you know, shall we say, traditional clustered option. You've got your green space in the middle, the homes all beautifully clustered around and fronting onto the lawn, and the parking's off to the side. And, you know, we've heard loud and clear this is really difficult to build because it's really hard to find these lots. There's also, you know, different consumer needs and interests in terms of how the homes and the parking are arranged. We've also seen the county code being used for, you know, for some of this types of clustered housing. This is a long, narrow lot, but they are able to get sort of that shared green space between the homes and parking offsite. But that there's a lot of interest in different ways to use the cottage code to build at this smaller scale, but using more of a, shall we say, a street-oriented arrangement, so that they're more individual lots, a little bit more circulation through the site, getting parking a little closer to individual units, changing the way that the cottages and the green space relate. So,
could you go back to that for a second, Elizabeth? I had a question for Jamie, or maybe Steve Hornstein could jump in here. My question is, you know, on the left hand side here, you've got traditionally subdivided and individual lots. On the right, you don't have those traditional lots. So would this right development fall underneath the Condominium Act in the state of Washington? That's my question for Jamie, and if Steve wants to jump in here, because I'm still very leery of building anything that is a condo in the state of Washington.
This is Steve. It wouldn't necessarily be a condo. You have to opt into the whole condominium regime statute and structure. And we're not seeing very many developers willing to do those these days. It wouldn't have to be, short answer.
Well, I just look at this and go, I don't know if these lots, or the one on the right, would actually be able to show individual lots to meet the minimum size. So that's kind of where I'm asking that question.
Yeah, Dan, my take on it would be that at least by what the picture I'm looking at, it seems like it would lend itself to doing a condo development. I think Steve's right. You would have to opt into that. I'll say that I had an experience with not a vertically integrated condo project, but a horizontal one like this, and it was a complete and utter nightmare. Because the condo statute isn't geared towards horizontal development. It's really geared towards vertical.
We have to find a way to make this work as a subdivision or a PUD, whatever would fit best. But I think the minute we're requiring condominiums, the market will stop.
I would be very hesitant to be able to do anything with condo the way the condo liability laws are in the state of Washington. I know they've attempted to get them a little bit better, but still, you know, my first multifamily project was a condominium clear back in 1996, and that was the last one that we've done just because the laws changed shortly thereafter. So thank you, Elizabeth.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Great. And so just looking at the comparison here of these two tracks, cottages, we're keeping that cluster of 4 to 12 homes, but there could be any number of clusters in a project. We did explore whether to cap the number of clusters and heard pretty clearly that wasn't a necessary standard, that the sites would dictate that. Compact lots currently being proposed at 3 or under 3 net acres. Refined that a little because we heard, you know, some sites have additional area that's unbuildable. But because, you know, the compact lot is really trying to address a more specific problem of, you know, what used to be called infill lots. And so because there's such an additional development potential offered in terms of doubling the density, that there was an idea that these really did need to be focused rather than, you know, simply applying to any lot, any development anywhere in the county. So that felt like targeting to those smaller lots could really be more useful because those are the ones that perhaps were being leapfrogged over, were not able to be developed under the current code. So they might need this additional help under the compact lot option. But the density is proposed as the same for both the cottage and the compact lot options. The unit size, we're not proposing to change the 1600 1,600 square foot size for cottages. There is no unit size restriction proposed for these compact lots. No changes to the height for cottages. Compact lots, it's proposed to be the underlying zone, which is 35 feet. The open space provisions for cottages, we're proposing to actually add a definition for common open space. I know some of the recent proposals have struggled over what does it actually mean. So proposing to add a definition and make that clearer. Compact lots, again, because they're more street focused, grid oriented, sort of they are going to rely on private yards for any open space rather than a requirement for open space, common open space. And then again, just the biggest difference is this orientation in terms of how the homes are intended to face either that open space and more of that clustered arrangement for cottages, which we've sort of clarified and made a little more focused in the cottage track, but really opened up in the compact lot track that the homes can face the street and that this is where those street frontage requirements, that balance of living and garage space would apply specifically to these developments. So any other questions on this concept?
I do have a question on it, or maybe more of a comment. On the compact lot, I see this really working out well in infill situations where you have a small site that you can maybe even tear down an existing home and do something like more of a compact lot type development. So that under 3 acres, man, I don't know that you're going to see that many parcels available in Clark County over the next few years that are over 3 acres. I think we're going to see a lot of infill stuff, tearing down a few existing homes. I don't expect the boundary to expand very significantly. So it's going to be a tough, it's going to limit the applicability, I guess, or the availability of land to do a compact lot. And then I also want to go back a few slides to that recent county cottage project proposal.
Sure.
That slide. So here's some of the challenges. So this was a project, we looked at this one for them. We had some different comments, but I know the developer on it, and their original target was to hit 650 per lot for a condo unit and no garages. And that was like their starting. I think they had to lower the price a little bit just to kind of get going. But right now they have a unit for $589. That's their starting price for a one bedroom before there's any options added. And it goes up from there. So $589 for a one bedroom. The larger unit in there starts at $699. So you're looking at your price per square footage. It's going to be hard for those projects to pencil out actually at those prices. And I don't know who's going to pay for that. I'm really concerned if they would appraise for that, if you could even get financing on a per square footage basis. And then you also, are we really hitting affordable with this type of layout? The density is not there. They're not actually taking advantage of the density bonus with this one. They're probably not getting a high enough yield. So you're not getting a higher enough density and you're not getting affordable housing out of it. So we really need to make sure that when we do these regulations, we're actually hitting the target that we're trying to do to create more density and less expensive housing. So, but I wanted to kind of bring that up because it does make a difference. And also getting an appraisal on any home without a garage is extremely difficult. It kind of caps what they'll appraise at, and appraisals can be directly linked to how many garage stalls there are. So when we talk about design standards, we talk about limiting garages, one of the main comments we had was to make sure that we don't count the garage space in a cottage against the square footage. And I know that was kind of passed back and forth. It's like, oh, that was going to get taken care of with a biannual. Well, then staff basically said, no, we're going to take care of it with middle housing. So everyone was pointing in a different direction, and it hasn't been addressed. And we need to address it with this code. This is the time to do it. So that should be included in the code changes to make sure that we have a subtraction for the garage area. It was never intended to count towards it. I was at those meetings. I was part of it. The examples we were looking at had garages on them, some of them, and we weren't counting them against the square footage. So it's something we need to take a look at.
Yeah, thanks. And I just wanted to offer a quick clarification. I didn't include this project as an example of this is what we want the code to accomplish, but more Just to point out that there is some interest in trying to build a more clustered development under the county's current code, but that it does have some of these challenges, as you're pointing out. And so hopefully some of the refinements to the cottage path can help address some of these issues, as well as creating that compact lot option, for developments that want to go in a different direction. So I agree that this project isn't necessarily the only way that we would want to see that cottage code being used in the future. All right, well, let's take a look. We got just two more. I was going to say two easy ones left, but parking's one of them, so maybe not that easy. With these code updates, in part because there are new housing types being introduced, and also a reconsideration of some of the existing ones, really saw the need to prioritize room for more of these housing types we're proposing by reducing some of the parking minimums, right? As you all know, minimums in the code, more parking can be built that exceeds the minimums. The minimums are just the floor. So few changes that are included in this package would be to reduce cottage parking to one space per unit for these duplex, triplex, and quadplex options that we're proposing in the code. It would set parking minimums at one space per unit. And the guest parking for townhouses would get shifted so that it can be as shared street parking rather than the current ratio of 2.5 spaces per townhouse. So this is what that's going to look like in terms of, summed up in a nice table. Duplex, triplex, and quadplex going to one space. Single family home is staying at two spaces. The townhouse goes from that sort of wonky 2.5 spaces per unit. As we understood, that half space is really intended to create some guest parking options, and it can either be on the individual unit in shared off-street parking spaces or on street. And so we thought there was an opportunity to better clarify that as two spaces per unit, and then an additional one space per three units as guest parking that can either be on street or in shared off street areas. And so, you can do the math. That's 0.33 spaces. So we're going from really 2.5 to 2.33. Not a big overall change, but trying to be more specific that if that extra increment is intended for guest parking, let's really build it as guest parking. And then cottages and compacts are going to one space, the compact lot, because of the layout. We also saw the utility of having guest parking in those developments. And then the ADUs are being proposed to clarify that it expands from most ADUs being able to qualify for no parking to a straight zero space per unit for all ADUs, to just make it a little bit clearer. Any questions about parking?
I had one with regard to the guest parking. It looks like it pushes it under the narrow lot standards, and it refers to those spaces on street only on local access streets. Is that intended to include neighborhood circulator streets?
That detail hadn't come up yet, so I appreciate that call out.
Seth, I think that in the past, when we've looked at narrow lot developments and being able to have off-street parking, but they can back right into the right-of-way, I believe that was still allowed on neighborhood circulators only because it wasn't an arterial or a collector.
I had it come up recently, well, not one of my projects, but others in the office, where it was interpreted as local access only, not neighborhood circulators. So I guess I just wanted to point out that there has been issues in the past. So.
Okay, I think that'd be a question more for Jennifer to get some clarification on that, because that oftentimes when we're doing these developments, we have streets or lots fronting on to neighborhood circulators, and at least one in almost every development. And if we can't have that guest parking be able to back into the right of way on neighborhood circulators, we're pushing then all of the guest parking onto the adjacent local access roads.
Right. And I think the project that I was referring to is actually, it was a comment that came from planning, not engineering.
So. Oh, okay. If it came from planning, then I would defer to engineering as far as that interpretation is, because it's still a local road, a local access road. It's just a higher classification because it would then connect adjacent neighborhoods.
I think the issue comes because of the on the table, it's referred to as local streets, but then there's one of the specific local streets is
the
a
local
access street.
Road, right.
And so the way this refers to local access, it almost appears to that one specific type.
Right.
I got a question for you guys. On G5, it calls out for a 20-foot separation of driveways in the narrow cottage. I've done a lot of townhouses, and I've basically a shared driveways. I've just put a 2-foot strip of river rock in there between them. What do you guys think about the 20-foot separation as it being a minimum? I think that's a little too great when you get into a narrow lot, the compact lot stuff.
Okay, where is that you see that?
It was G5.
So, Dan, I don't think that applies to shared driveways, though, right? That's if you only have an individual driveway.
Correct.
So
I just thought 20-foot separation would be quite a bit.
Yeah. Option.
And the
is
first
that under the compact lot development. That's directly under the compact lot development standards, isn't it?
Yeah, under the main entrance orientations.
I don't see how that would pop.
Yeah.
We see it.
So there might be an unintended consequence, too, of
yeah.
Not only that, but the one space per 3 units guest parking. And right now, under the townhouse code, that's not required. And when you do a townhouse in, say, R18, R12, R22, but you don't have that rule.
I think you do.
No, you have the we actually
have the narrow lot.
You have the narrow lot standards, and then
right.
That was my other thing too. Is how does this relate to the narrow lot standards? And instead of guest parking, which usually means you lose units, you lose density, and it's somewhere else on site. If you actually provide the parking on the lot itself, and you are able to do two cars. So, for example, on the compact lot. Only one space was required per unit. Well, what if you provide two spaces on your site? You're providing way more than the required parking, and there's not as much need for the guest parking. So is the one space per 3-unit guest parking required when you go down to the minimum one space per unit? It shouldn't really apply if you have two spaces per unit. The same thing on the townhouses, one space per 3 units, that's actually more restrictive than the narrow lots standards. And they should be in line. So I don't know if we go with that at all. I think we need to look at a better way to do that.
What do the narrow lot standards say?
2.5 stalls per unit. So we actually argued against requiring specific guest parking areas because it was restrictive and was loss of density. So if you get 2.5 units. Or 2.5 spaces on site, you didn't have to provide an off-site parking lot or street parking or those other things. So even though it might be under a certain code section, the way staff may interpret it, it may spill out into being more restrictive on existing developments like townhouses in the zones that they typically are built under, which is like R18 or R22.
Eric, I think you guys need to look at the proposed narrow driveway standards in 40.260 as well. It's marked X. It's in between 7 and 8.
Again?
It's going to be 40.26X.
Okay.
16 of 21, it says. That whole section, there's some pretty adverse consequences to that.
So that's part of the narrow lot development, proposed narrow lot development standards, additional requirements.
So
4260-155X.
X.
And driveway's no wider than 10 feet. I think we've already talked about this.
We started having a discussion around it. That's just the whole, even having a 10-foot wide
right.
driveway means it forces you to have a 10-foot wide max garage.
You're
or, is it a 10-foot wide throat that could widen out into something? I don't know.
It doesn't specify it doesn't. That. And if we're looking at like code interpretations,
yep.
the county has been taking the most stringent, which
yeah.
would be 10 foot across the entire thing, which,
right.
again, not practical.
You may also...
Which shall be either single car width and located no closer to the street than the front wall on the porch of the residence, or if wider than a single car garage, how could it
could
be that? That's 10 feet, setback at least 5 feet.
So section
this isn't making any sense.
Section D is going to have some really adverse architectural impacts, as will section B, especially when you're on attached product and you're trying to dial in elevation. Sometimes you can't get those garages, or if you're dealing with slope on a site and your garages need to be high side all the way up. Both of those are going to have impacts on affordability.
Yeah, again, stuff like that makes them where people, they're not going to build them, and they're not going to appraise. You're going to have one-car garages, no parking. We're almost creating a problem in one section that we have to solve by eliminating density and providing off-site parking.
Exactly.
We should be able to do it a better way. So these have unintended consequences, and they create a product that probably fits some, you know, I'm not sure where this comes from and why it's even necessary.
I think it would fit real well around a mass transit facility to where you have individuals with one car per household, but that's not where the majority of our buying public and our public in general is. I mean, the people that are going to be able to afford houses like this, or even they're going to be fairly expensive to rent, the majority are probably going to have two cars. You're going to have, you know, Cartropolis and a problems around just these developments with the cars, and that's going to piss off the neighborhood.
There are a lot of moving factors, for sure. I think that some of the different pieces, and to your point earlier, Eric, about challenging, I know we're running up against time and also format, so we think about a way to get into some more detailed comments about this particular section of code. But the idea on those narrow lots is we heard through the plan development as well as in the forum series, just a number of concerns around parking that are trying to be balanced in the code, both this idea that individuals want more parking on their site, that there could be the option to build it, but also so that those driveways don't completely overwhelm the sidewalk and create conflicts. A desire to use those driveways and those garages for storage perhaps by individuals, but if that's what individuals are choosing to do with their space, then that might not leave any guest parking available. So concern that if there are guests, that there really is some options in the neighborhood to have some guest parking so that there are fewer spillover impacts to adjacent neighborhoods. For sure, reality is complex, trying to balance all those pieces. And I think to respect your agenda, the feedback that we're getting so far to dial in on this is really useful. And maybe we can talk about a way to focus more on some of those details and continue the conversation. Any other specific thoughts right now? Steve, you're on mute right now. If you're
sorry about that. We have a lot of planners and engineers and land use lawyers here.
Yeah.
and a few developers, but I wonder if there's been enough or will be enough outreach to the people that actually build these things to talk to them about this as well as this group of people. What is the plan for that, if there is one?
Jackie, do you want to talk about that?
Sorry, had to find my mute button.
Yeah, no problem.
So we are reaching out and have been working with this group, the Development Engineering and Advisory Board. We also, with our Housing Project Advisory Group, invited participation from the BIA and the realtors and a variety of different developers to participate on that. And we do in our technical code forum also have developers, as well as not always only for-profit, but nonprofit developers. So we're doing our best to get everyone that can be at the table to help us through this, but also open to suggestions if there's other groups or other individuals that we could reach out to.
Well, that sounds like a good group. I just think it's really important that the people that actually have to build these and sell these things feel that that they can work with this, because if they don't, then it's kind of all for in vain. So thank you, Jackie, for that. It sounds like you thought that through pretty well.
Well, we did our best to, from the very beginning, pull yeah. together a balanced group of individuals to develop the housing option study, and then with our technical housing code forum, draw from those groups as well as this group and the planning commission to really vet these out. And so yeah. that's what we've been doing.
Good work.
All right. Well, let me just share the last wrap-up slides, and then I do want to be respectful of your agenda and the time you've generously shared for us. The last one, hopefully, is a welcome concept around streamlining the permitting process. So generally, as we worked on these standards, they're all intended to be clear standards that are easier to apply. You know, I think we've heard how there's been some challenging interpretations and just trying to work through that. So trying to sort out the ones that come up, and appreciate you calling out any others that you see as we're working at this code level. Working on a building permit level review. So just like single family homes now can be approved, having that same level of review for ADUs, townhouses, or ADUs, duplexes, and individual townhouses once that subdivision is approved. Introducing a type 1 site plan review for triplexes and quadplexes, thinking that a type 2 site plan review is currently required and is, you know, really totally overkill for three or four units. But that the requirement for the type 2 site plan review would remain for cottages, compact lots, and the initial townhouse development itself, with a parallel subdivision review if new lots are being created. So that's what I have in terms of the concepts. We are working our way through this project review schedule. Thank you so much for spending today with us. We are scheduled to go to Planning Commission for a second work session in June before the public hearing, and then based on their feedback, working with the County Council. And so thank you for your time today. Welcome your feedback on additional concepts or other ways that you'd like to be involved. You can email Jackie, and she'll get all of the comments distributed to the project team, as well as visit the project website. I can drop that in the chat real quick here for you all, but thank you for having me today.
Who's the presenter that has already?
So, got it. Okay, just to let everybody else know who's on virtually right now, we are currently muted
here in the conference room, and we're trying to get that resolved. And this is kind of what happened last month when we didn't have microphones. So we're all still here. I think for the purposes of people who are online, as well as those in the room, I would move Mr. Chair to bring this back as another topic of conversation for our next meeting, since it will be in advance of both the it'll be after the Planning Commission work session, but before the Planning Commission hearing. So I'd like to have this as another topic at our next meeting so that we can discuss this further. I think that there's more that we can discuss than we have time for today.
Hi, this is Noelle Levern with the BIA. Jackie mentioned that we had been invited to participate. That was not made clear. And I would like to invite the option to gather some of our builders together and offer the opportunity to provide some more feedback on these options. I think we have some great builders within our association that would love to provide feedback.
Yeah, and just to clarify, we with the housing option study at the beginning, the project advisory group that helped develop the plan, the invitation was sent out to through press release and sent to the BIA to have a representative. So that's how that one worked. And then with our technical code forum, we are using members of that project advisory group, the county's development engineering advisory board, and the planning commission, and welcome any comments from any individual that would like to submit for that group and for our project staff team to consider. So yes, we welcome any feedback and all suggestions. Just wanted to clarify that.
You get us that, Norm. Okay. Well, you can. Okay. So does that wrap up this? Here. Why don't you take over on that?
Just, yeah. All right. Well, we'll go ahead and move on to the next item here, which is a comp plan growth rate update. And Eric.
You know, with the technical difficulties, I'm going to keep it really brief. The county adopted a 1.4% growth rate. The range was, the middle was 1.26, I believe. Let me grab my notes here. The range was 1.26 for the medium. Yeah, let me get to the right page. It was like 1.51. So the low OFM projection was 0.6, the medium was 1.26, and the high was 1.51. So they adopted a 1.4, which is slightly over the middle. But what I find pretty interesting is the population number that we were they pushed to adopt is really close to the middle. And it's not really not even halfway close to the high. So it was like, I think something like 717 or something. Let me find that one now. What was it? 718. So, yeah. So when you look at it, we're just really 20,000 over the middle, instead of the difference between the middle and the high was almost 100,000. So we're really close to the middle still. It's better than I think what we had before. But when you look at the impacts of the vacant buildable lands model, even this lower growth rate where historically we've grown at close to 2%, even using the 1.4, the housing options adding density, and the vacant buildable lands model saying we have twice as much land, I don't expect the boundary to really increase much. So we need to consider that. All those things add up. So it was really important, I think, to try to get at least a little bit higher growth rate to accommodate what we're actually going to see. We recommended going higher, I think, as a board. And one thing that was a little disappointing is our memo didn't make it to the first hearing. It made it just a few minutes before. So in the future, we need to make sure we get that to them earlier and reach out. So, I mean, no fault on anyone's, but just logistically, we didn't get it to them until right before the hearing. So they didn't have a chance to review it and then reach out to us about comments. So.
I figured my voice would carry, but I do know. I just find it frustrating we go through things like this when by adopting a higher number or tweaking, working on the vacant buildable lands model and everything else, it's a low-hanging fruit for affecting affordability. But if we can't move our boundaries much, we're going to be so constrained. It's going to be...
There's no point in going through stuff like that.
No, it's not, never, never. I thought, and what were some of the past when we, you know, back in the day, years ago, I thought we were up in the twos or three, even, like, arguing three. I mean,
yeah, historically, I think we've been close to 2% over the last 20 years.
Yeah. Well, we've also done emergence, you know, like, during Pine Moore and Betty Sue and all that, we did the interim, you know, two-year deal. I'm just saying, this needs to be, and if we have a counselor still on, I mean, this is a joke. To low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, I know there was comments in regards to OFM and how they come up with their projections, and it you have to consider serious pullback in what our population growth has been over the last 20 years and the last 10 years, and I know that slowing birth rates have been discussed, but migration and what we've experienced has been exceeded by far any slowdown in birth rate. And so I don't if and then where how is this structured and created? You know, I heard one comment being from California, and I don't know whether that's accurate or not. But if it is, obviously you have migration out of California for a lot of different reasons. I think with our affordability of electricity, our availability of water, cooler temperatures, we would see over time that migration would actually push further north with time. And that should have been considered for the entire state. Specifically probably the western half of Washington state. I don't think that we're going to accomplish anything as it relates to arguing OFM and what OFM provides for the different projections for us to accept, but I do not understand why a high rate would not be accepted based off the fact there was 10-year and 20-year look back of data of population growth numbers that far exceeded what the high projection was from OFM. And so that I don't understand how we say that we care about affordable housing when that we didn't take the highest number that was available that would help to provide for that affordable housing. And it goes back to what Eric also spoke to as well. The vacant buildable lands model to me is broken as far as what we see as usable. That every time we look at it is land that is not used. There's a reason for it. And it indirectly cooks the, you know, what we're looking at in land that's available, and it shifts our statistics and data that we're seeing. The data is only as accurate, the numbers, the calculations only as accurate as the data that we use to implement towards that calculation. And so there's lots of different opinions, and I understand that we could be seen as a group that, you know, would be trying to put more housing available, but that is exactly what was found by the lieutenant governor as the key point. That's our biggest issue for our economy is having affordable housing available, more housing available. We're dealing with it at a state level. We've never seen these many bills put forward. So I feel like we get double speak, and it's frustrating. And I think if we want to go talk about the affordability side, supply and demand is a real economic principle, and I feel like it it has somehow been wiped away as if it's not something that's real. And I don't understand that. It's a viable discussion. I think adding the flexibility with the density is great. And I think we just want to make sure that it's a concept that comes forward that's usable and can be used to help to provide the housing. I want children to have the same opportunity to come up that I had and that people before us had to be able to purchase a home and have a home. The future is going to be renting a home is where it's pushing a lot of people. And that's just really unfortunate based off of the economic impacts it has for individuals.
Well, and sitting in the hearing, I found it interesting the number of individuals who maybe didn't fully understand what we were arguing for. There was a lot of conversation around, well, we don't have roadways for all the existing people, and we don't have this, and we don't have that. But they weren't putting that correlation that it's because we couldn't plan for it because we didn't pick the right number 10, 20 years ago. And so I found it interesting that that message wasn't being heard, that we have to pick the right number if we don't want to have those issues moving forward. So above and beyond housing, I mean, just some, that was a lot of the argument against, you know, hearing testimony was, there's too many people already. We don't want more people. Well, that the number doesn't change the number of people that are coming here. It changes how we react to the people that are coming here and what we plan for. So I don't know if there's a way education for there to be more education from people in the development space to connect with people throughout this process to really inform them. I don't know what that looks like, but.
Anybody else?
But I guess just to clarify, it looks like the Planning Commission public hearing on June 1st is for the proposed code changes relating to the Housing Options Action Plan. So our next meeting will be just prior to that. Oh, this is a work session.
Oh, it's a work session? That's June 1st is a work session.
But it might be a good idea to have someone from staff here as well to kind of listen to our discussion and the reasons behind it. But I think this is mostly not, it's not going to be a presentation from staff at that one. This is going to be us bringing our comments together and coming up with our recommendation and kind of our internal work session. But it'd be good to have someone, some of the same participants here to hear our deliberation and the reasons why we're recommending it instead of just our comments. So let's try to get staff here for the consultant.
BIA. Sorry about that one.
No, that's okay. All
right. Sorry. I'd like to see this thing get juiced up a little bit, have more eyes on it.
The last item here is the biennial code amendments. We talked about it last time, and April said that if we had any additional items, we could bring them today, and she could still incorporate them. I had a couple of items related to mixed use. We talked about the townhomes in it quite extensively. The other item was the FAR, floor area ratio, which was previously discussed, which is set at 0.5 maximum for single family homes, which I think doesn't meet the intent there, as well as the allowed uses. That list doesn't allow private recreation facilities in the mixed use zone, which I think there's a lot of opportunities there to have mixed use facility or the private recreation facility is in a mixed use, but it's not an allowed use. It's only public recreation facilities. So those are just a few items that I had noted. Another one that came up was with regard to driveway spacing, and the fact that it's across the street was brought up as it's not meeting spacing. And I think that's, you know, the code for intersection specifically addresses it as aligned across or meet intersection spacing. So I think that would be something that, if possible, to just incorporate into that section of the driveway spacing code.
Seth, I'm going to make a suggestion that I think April mentioned that she needed it 30 days from our last deed meeting. Since that was only 3 weeks ago, I think we have another week. So as I've always said before, with any proposed code that we bring forward, we need to propose the change as well as the language that we would like to see included in there, whether it's omit this, take this out, or add this, or change this language to read this way. That way, that gives staff the ability to then review it on their side to see if that's something that they can have. Oftentimes, they have brought those to us directly. We have not brought a whole lot to them, but I think that they would be looking to us to maybe do a little legwork on our own, is that if we're going to bring through forward a proposed code amendment or code change to go in the biannuals, that we also provide our requested language. So that's the only thing that I would say. And if that's something you could do within the next week and get it to April, just copy us. We'd be happy to support you in it.
Okay. With that, nearing the end of our time, is there any public comment?
And before you say that, before that happens, I have to turn my phone down before anybody speaks online. Is there anybody in here? Okay. Oh, yeah. Justin's going to speak.
This is Justin Wood, Clark County Association of Realtors. I've mentioned this before at a D meeting regarding allowable uses in the agricultural 20 zone in regards to event hosting and event space. Currently, the way the code is written, wineries are only allowed to host up to 100 and leave its events up to 150 people and a certain number of days out of the year. And our local farmers aren't afforded that same allowable use. So we did draft a letter earlier last year. There was a Columbian article in June of last year kind of examining this issue. And I believe, you know, some other organizations like Friends of Clark County and possibly some counselors for the county would like to see a change there as well. So I will forward that off to April. I believe I already sent her an email, but would love to have that conversation. Thank you.
Thanks,
Mike. Can you hear me?
Somebody does. Hold on.
Can you hear me?
Go for it.
I am doing a wineries versus rural event center presentation to council during a work session, I believe next week.
Marie's going to follow up with a few comments on kind of the density stuff and circle in on a few things that Terry was talking about. I'm going to try to be pretty quick because I'm running short just for next meeting. Supply and demand came up. I think the majority of the density increase code is good, but if we're looking to solve affordability by this code section in its whole, it's not going to happen. It may actually backfire. I know Jeff buys land, Terry buys land, Dan buys land, I buy land. And one of the key factors in buying land on the price is the density. So the less dense the land is, the cheaper it is typically, and the higher, the more expensive it is. So we know R30 is twice the price of R15, okay? But now you start making implications that you have R175 through R15 where you can put 21.8 units on the acre, or you can bring lot sizes down to 2,000. Now you just jacked affordability way up, okay? Now if anybody wants to put a single family lot, a 5,000 square foot lot, how expensive is that lot kit? Did that lot just go from 130 or 150 to 200, 250? You're going to put a whole class of people that are looking for a particular type out, okay? That's going to probably run the gamut, okay, without looking at a holistic view. And then, I mean, Dan can chime in if he wants to, because I know he builds both products as well. But townhomes versus an attached product versus detached product, on the structure itself, they're not really any different in price. Attached product actually may be more expensive because you have additional items like firewalls and fire sprinklers, whereas you're not going to have that on the detached product. The biggest difference you're going to get is one right now. You do get a little bit of economy on the land to some degree, but the permits is where you're getting the biggest deal. Okay. You know, Battleground, your school impact fee, I think, for an attached product is $3,000 versus a detached is $10,000 now. So you're getting a spread on it that way. So maybe, you know, permit or impact fees need to be looked at as well if you're trying to create a diversified product type. I guess I could chime on for about an hour, so I'm going to stop it. I'm going to stop it.
Anybody have their hand up? Okay. Do you want to ask about any more public comment?
Yeah, is there any public comment online?
Seeing none? Oh, there's a. Okay, hang on. Okay, whoever had their hand up, I'm going to push mute on my phone. They're going to turn it up, and then you can go ahead and talk, right? Oh, is it Teresa? Okay, Teresa, you're up.
Friends of Clark County is supporting that opportunity for wine events and things, so we are in agreement with that. Perhaps from your point of view, it doesn't seem like you have a lot of voice in the housing options, but from the public perspective, from land use volunteer organizations within the county, as we look at how we use land moving forward, we see that the Planning Commission is involved in the housing option. And Planning Commission, those seven people all have development background in some aspect or another. We see DEEB involved, and there are 11 of you that are also involved in development and planning. And we see the Tech Forum, which is made up of planning commissioners, DEEB, and some of the people who are at this meeting, and other developers. So from a public perspective, it does seem like the development community has the opportunity for a lot of input on this. The public can only attend, as I said last time, Planning Commission work sessions, of which there's no input, and hearings for the Planning Commission and County Council, which are 3 minutes each. So it's difficult to hear that you don't have an opportunity to submit and give your input. There were a couple of things that did come up at the hearing on the population projection. One of the things that we, the public, saw was that almost all of the mayors showed up for the first hearing, and then many came back yesterday. And because capital facilities looking at impact fees had to be done for five or six of the school districts, and there was a lot of discussion about tying education and curriculum and where we are with standardized testing and our standardized scores. And if we don't have high standardized scores, how are we going to expect developers to pay more higher impact fees? And it became just a quagmire of discussion, which meant that the discussion on the population got pushed back farther and farther. And that meeting went on for almost 4 hours with population near the end. And I think people were kind of worn out. But there were the mayor of Vancouver was there again. She left before she had an opportunity to speak. Eric Paulson was there, and the mayors from the cities all proposed the middle housing, the middle population range. So there is a wide range of people within the county and the cities that did propose that. Another consideration that came up was, if we just open up land, are we going to open it up? Council member Marshall brought this up, and this has been brought up before, about 179th. So do we just open up land? We have concurrency where you're supposed to have the money for the infrastructure. We can see what's already happened on 179th, where we make land available, we have developers buying it, and we don't have the road structure that will support that. So there are a lot of factors being brought up at these meetings that I think also need to have some consideration. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you. Seeing no further hands raised, the next DEEB meeting is scheduled for June 1st. And with that, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.